It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Thank you so much for giving us the most precious thing you have, your time. So we continue to do what we always do, turn down the noise of the news cycle, get to the information we need to properly discern the times we live in. And we need to discern something here because it doesn't happen very often. I don't know if people's even kind of thought about it this way, but it kind of is important. So let's talk about it for a second. Vice President Kamala Harris, who's running for president, and former President Donald Trump, who is also running for president, have agreed on something. Now, that's something to note just in and of itself, but they not only agree on something, they're both pitching the same policy. Now, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of this in a second, but they've both started talking about this no tax on tips thing. This is a very populist economic thing. Now they're fighting over it because Kamala Harris spoke about it in Las Vegas, and the context here is important. If you don't know a lot about Las Vegas, I lived there for a time. She's speaking to a very large crowd in the arena in Las Vegas. The people behind her on the stage and the people that are really behind the rally is Culinary Local 226. Now, Las Vegas is obviously, everybody knows about the casinos and the resorts and the gambling and the nightlife and the restaurants, and it's a great food city now, and blah, 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 blah. Everybody knows what Las Vegas is. That means lots and lots and lots of service workers. Predominantly, the number one jobs in Vegas are either service sector jobs and then the ecosystem around the service sector jobs that keep those casinos and hotels and resorts going. So one of the more powerful unions is the culinary union out there. If you're wondering how powerful they are, Harry Reid is all you need to know there. They're a very powerful union. She's speaking to that union. That union supports this. No tax on tips. So she said it in front of the union and is apparently going to adopt this as part of her thing. Now, the Trump people are fussing because Trump started talking about this back in June, at least publicly. No tax on tips. He's talked about it in interviews. He's talking about it in his rallies. So now the Trump people are all like, she stole it from us. Well, maybe they did, but the thing about it is this has actually been around a while. If you go back to 1983, I'm going to link to some of this. Wrote about it in ordinary-times.com. We actually linked to this way back in 1983 when Reagan was redoing the tax code as part of his the great reawakening, economic reawakening that he pushed through, mostly through tax reform. One of the tax reforms they were arguing about was taxation on tips. So something very interesting here happened. When two ideologically and politically opposites agree on something, that usually puts up my antenna like, well, wait a minute, why are they both agreeing on that? They should fight about everything. Then when the ideological and politically opposed pundits and wonks and policy people who don't agree on anything all agree that them agreeing on it is a bad thing, that really puts up a red flag on me. This is unusual. This doesn't happen very often. Former President Trump, Vice President Harris, they're agreeing on something. And then the ecosystems that usually support them or cheerlead them, the pundits and the wonks and the policy people, they all agree with each other that this is all a horrible idea. So what's really going on here? I wrote about this in Ordinary Times. You can look to it. We're going to link. Two different things happened here. So I'm just going to give you, instead of breaking this down, because I've already reached out to Alex Marisal, good friend of ours that works for the Tax Foundation. I'm going to quote one of the things he wrote here along with another piece that's in the opposite. And I've reached out to him. I'm going to try to get him on the program because I really want to dig into this, because populism and policy is a very bad thing. Populism and buzzwords on the campaign stump sound great, but then when you get into it, there's all sorts of problems with it. So let's take a view from the progressive side, the left side, however you want to say it. The American Prospect publication, that usually progressive ideas, liberal ideas, they wrote this about this idea. I'm quoting here. The combination of needing that endorsement and not wanting to have Trump outflank her on something that sounds vaguely populist led Harris to say these words on Saturday, quote, "When I am president, we will continue to fight for working families of America, including raising the minimum wage and eliminating taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers," end quote. Pause right here. Remember, she's talking in front of the Culinary Union. And I know there's other people there, but that's kind of the host. Those are the people that are standing behind her with the signs. That was the target audience of this speech. So it's important to note the context here. She's talking to service and hospitality workers, trying to get up the vote in Nevada that not only has the presidential election in play, they have a very hotly contested U.S. Senate race along with everything on the down ballot. Context matters. Back to the piece from the American Prospect. The campaign officials said these two concepts, which would need congressional approval, would travel together. There's this whole other side issue here that presidential candidates promise stuff that they can't do anyway because Congress does it, but we'll hash that out some other time. Probably bring that up during the debates. Back to the piece. No taxes on tips is generally a poor idea. Remember, this is the American Prospect. This is a viewpoint from the progressive left. No taxes on tips is generally a poor idea where there are other good ones available. It would somewhat unfairly segregate people who make the same income by virtue of how that income is technically collected. It invites gaming of the system, where real estate and stockbrokers, lawyers, or even hedge fund managers can recharacterize their income as tips and get a huge tax break. The Harris aide said they would put income limits and strict requirements, that's in quotes, probably air quotes, to prevent such gaming. Sure they will. No taxes on tips is generally a poor idea where there are other good ones available. It would nullify efforts to improve reporting compliance on tips, and if this affected payroll as well as income taxes, which businesses would certainly push for on the employee side as well, it could catastrophically reduce what tipped workers pay into and get out of Social Security, for example. Worker retirement income would be based only on their meager base wages, while Social Security and Medicare would lose something like $250 billion over a decade, hastening the insolvency of the trust. By the way, that's completely accurate. The trust is insolvent, and it's going to happen. Props for them for bringing that up. Back to the piece. A great number of workers don't qualify to pay much, if any, federal income taxes, particularly in the service and hospitality sector. That means this tax break may not do much for current workers while potentially hurting them in retirement. If you do owe income taxes as a service worker, you're on the higher end of the income scale. So the break is generally regressive. That's a viewpoint from the American Prospect, more of a progressive viewpoint on this. Now, the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation also has a piece about this. This is from our buddy Alex Mirozano, who is more on the right, a little more libertarian, a little bit more conservative than this. Listen to what he says about this exact same idea. Again, Alex isn't going to get published in the American Prospect, but they come to the same conclusion, although they come at it from two different angles. Listen closely to the piece. By making one type of income, in this case tips, exempt from income tax while other types of income, like wages, remain taxable, the proposal would make more employees and businesses interested in moving from full wages to a tip-based payment approach. That would mean more service industries adopting the restaurant industry approach of a list price up front and an expected voluntary tip at the end of the transaction. This kind of behavioral response makes it difficult to estimate the cost of no tax online proposals. A simple analysis of tipped income suggests a lower bound cost of around $107 billion over 10 years for income tax exemption only, assuming tips and a share of the total wage growth remains as it was in 2018. By the way, that would be pre-pandemic, pre-inflation levels. Assuming tips as share total wage remains as it was then. Applying a marginal tax rate on wages faced by taxpayers making between $30,000 and $40,000, that's the average for waiters and waitresses with a medium range of around $32,000 to $36,000. Small behavioral effects such as higher tips in existing tipped conditions would incrementally raise the costs. More substantial behavioral responses, such as previously untipped occupations, including introducing tipping, could make the policy dramatically more expensive. One could imagine a scenario. Listen to this. This is amazing. They came to the same conclusion from two different ways. One could imagine a scenario where a highly compensated lawyer or accountant began to receive some of their involuntary tips and voluntary tips as income. Lawmakers could design the exemption to prevent or minimize exploitation, such as restricting the tax exemption to taxpayers below a certain income threshold, or only to be tipped income received in traditionally tipped occupations. Additionally, for tip income to be tip income, the payment must be made voluntarily by the customer and cannot be previously agreed to among the restrictions. So arrangements to agreed upon quote-unquote tip, air quotes again, you can't see air quotes if you're on the podcast, sorry. We'll figure out a way to do that. That's good. It'd be like scratch and sniff technology, but air quotes. Tips before providing, say, legal services would be illegal, but they could prove challenging for the IRS to enforce. Additionally, lawmakers could reduce the incentives to recharacterize income by placing a cap on the amount of tip income that could be exempted. The existing no tax on tip bills, main one is pushed by Ted Cruz, you can read it yourself, and it's bipartisan, by the way, I'm not picking on him there, do not offer much in terms of safeguards to prevent potential abuse. But even with safeguards, the policies would be poor. Poorly targeted at low and middle income earners, given the relatively small share of the population working in tipped occupation. Worse, the exemption itself, and any safeguards added, would add to the complexity of the tax code overall. This is amazing stuff. One thing when you're dealing with a complicated policy, I've already told you many times, buzzwords is almost a dead ringer red flag. When something sounds good as a buzzword, you really need to dig into it. But one of the real big things here that we need to understand is just because somebody says something that sounds good doesn't mean the policy is good. And just because it's bipartisan and people of, you know, there's not going to, you can probably count on one or two hands the number of things that Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are going to agree to in this campaign. That should make you want to dig into it, though. One of the things with policy that you always want to ask, whether it's tax policy, foreign policy, especially regulations, things like that, things that will affect money and things that are designed for the government to raise money or taxation or fees or whatever. The first question you always ask yourself is, what is it intended to do, but how would you enforce it to make it do what it's intended to do? And what would be the unintended consequences if it doesn't do what it's intended to do and it's not enforced? Because what happens over and over again with these bills is they say they're going to do one thing, they get written into law, and then you have all the unintended consequences because nobody thought it out, and then you have a mess on your hands. How would you enforce no tax on tips? Tips that all, by the way, are already mostly go untaxed because a lot of them are in cash and people just don't declare them. Well, there's only one way you're going to do that. You're going to have to massively expand the IRS enforcement mechanisms. Remember the whole fight we had over hiring more IRS people? You really want to do that? Small government folks, you really want to do that? You want to do this policy that's badly written and wind up having to massively expand government just to enforce a policy that's probably not going to help what you think is going to help? Is that you want more invasion of civil liberties, folks that are on the progressive left? Is that how you want to do this? Think about these things. Now, there's probably a happy medium there that would be a good policy for no tax on tips that you could write. But that's not what we're being promised on the stump, and neither of these presidential candidates can do it anyway. It's got to be written by Congress. And if you trust Congress with your tips and your taxation without being very, very critical of them, well, frankly, you're part of the problem in our country right now because Congress can't seem to do anything very much right. And I doubt they do this because they would write the buzzword in the law and not pay attention to the details. We'll link to everything I just talked about in the show notes, herdtail.substack.com. We're going to try to get Alex on here hopefully in a week or so we can talk about these issues in depth. More Herdtail right after this.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. Let's talk culture and let's talk Olympics. I have gotten just so much of a kick, and my kids have too, and my family members, and a lot of people online I saw. The unofficial official mascot of the United States of America at these Olympics has been Snoop Dogg. Yeah, the rapper, entertainer, actor. Everybody loves Snoop Dogg. And he's been all over these Olympics. If you have not seen the little vignettes he's done where he's swimming with Michael Phelps, where he's wearing the dressage horse riding outfit, which is just hilarious. He got to carry the actual Olympic torch, which the interview of that's really, you could tell it meant something to him. It actually touched him to get to do that. Everybody loves Snoop. Snoop is laid back. Snoop is happy. We all know Snoop is chronically high. See that play on words I just did there? That's what you do when you're in the media business. Look, he's higher than a haircut all the time. God bless him. He's having a blast. I want you to use this as a thought exercise, though, and go back in time for a minute. If you're old enough to remember, and I am, when I was, you know, a teenager, I was blessed. No offense to the artists today, but I was blessed to grow up when hip hop and rap really exploded in America. And I know it goes all the way back to the late 70s and the stuff in the 80s, which I do listen to. I've gone back and listened to that and dug, but I didn't listen to it as a kid. I was too little. But, you know, there's a lot of really good old school hip hop stuff, especially in the Olympics where they did. My thing with the breakdancing in the Olympics wasn't that they had breakdancing. They had breakdancing, but wouldn't let the dancers pick their own music. They didn't have any of the old school hip hop anyway. And who's judging this thing? I think the way they did it was messed up, not the concept of doing it. Anywho, I mean, Snoop was right there. Put him in charge of it, for crying out loud. Anyway, I've always enjoyed rap music and hip hop. And look, I was mostly a metalhead combined with bluegrass because that's the traditional music where I grew up on, you know, family gatherings. My grandparents played guitar and sang. My grandmother, she played the three finger Maybell Carter style, which if you're not familiar with bluegrass and country and roots music, just an amazing guitar player with that Maybell Carter three finger guitar style. My grandfather would go to the nursing home on Sunday afternoons and sing for the people in the nursing home. By the time he got, and at the end of his life, he was too old and got too sick to do it. He was 10 years older than anybody in the nursing home was going and performing. So music's always been impressive, but I liked 90s, 80s, 90s hip hop. I couldn't help it. You know, the whole East Coast, West Coast thing. That's when I was a teenager and coming up. And when you're a kid in West Virginia, you're like, whoa, what is that? In Living Color, became a big hit TV show. And that's kind of the first time a lot of us saw rap music. We didn't have rap on radio, obviously. So that was the first time we really saw it. So like a kid in West Virginia, all of a sudden Onyx is on there. You're like, whoa, what is this? This is different. And I loved it. It's also the first time you ever saw Tupac because he was there dancing in the background for Heavy D of all things. There's a great hip hop history moment on Living Color where Heavy D is performing and both Sean Combs, who we now know as Puff Daddy, and Tupac is in the shot, and Tupac keeps getting in the shot as a dancer, and they keep having to cut off him to get back over to Heavy D. It's really funny. Tragically funny, I should say, because of how it all worked out. Anywho, Snoop Dogg. When I was that age and learning about rap, and rap was coming of age and was getting all over MTV and was becoming a cultural phenomenon, especially in the 90s, the Tipper Gores of the world and parental advisory. Remember all that? You know, if we weren't going to be Satanists because of Dungeons and Dragons and MTV wasn't going to make us all career criminals, then that darn rap music was going to make us all horrible people, right? Snoop was right in the middle of that. He caught a murder charge that he may or may not have been, you know, involved in, but he was acquitted on those murder charges. He did a whole song on it, you know. you know, Murder Was the Case That They Gave Me. It's a great rap song. Go find it. Death Row Records, all that stuff. Yeah, Snoop did all that stuff where he rapped a lot of misogynistic stuff. He said a lot of horrible things in those early records. He said some stuff he probably would like to walk back at some point. We'll see. So it's not that that stuff wasn't inappropriate for children. It was. It's not that you maybe shouldn't have some parental advisory on some things. It was. It was the cultural panic, just like the satanic panic, just like the MTV panic, just like everybody that ever smoked marijuana is going to immediately go insane and become a rage killer panic. Pick whatever cultural panic you want and moral panic you want. Snoop was involved in all that. But now 30 years later, he's the mascot of America at the Olympics. That's quite the shift. How did that happen? Well, as the great writer said, it happened gradually. Then suddenly, he hangs out with Martha Stewart, who actually did more prison time than Snoop ever did at Alderson, West Virginia. You know, I think you should apply this to the normal culture stuff that we see now and the debates we have. We're debating the internet. We're debating social media. We're debating content, TikTok, YouTube, these things. We're debating pornography. You know, pornography debate ain't new. That go look at the rise of pornography and the rise of home VCRs. They go together. The rise of pornography and the rise of the internet. They go together. These debates are complicated, but moral panic gives people this safe space to get up on their high horse and yell at people. But I just want you to stop and think for a second, all the for the children and how bad the children are going to do and these evil, wicked, everything. Snoop Dogg was the unofficial, official mascot of these Olympics. He was all over NBC. He was all over your social media feeds. Everybody loves Snoop Dogg. But 30 years ago, congressmen, senators, the future second lady of the United States was on TV and in front of committee hearings and on the national news telling kids like me that we were all going to go to hell and become Satanists and be horrible serial killers if we listened to that darn Snoop Dogg. It was silly then. It's silly now. And keep that in perspective when somebody online tells you that we're going to ruin a whole generation of children because of this, that, and the other. The kids will be mostly fine. The adults are really the problem. That doesn't mean you shouldn't parent in your home. You do. You know what I do with hip-hop? I listen to hip-hop with my kids. Talk to them. Hey, this ain't the best thing in the world, but here's the beat. Here's what's going on. It's called parenting. Don't shirk from those challenges. Just talk through it. Most of my kids like hip-hop. My kids have a pretty decent flow most of the time, and I'm okay with it. And they haven't become serial killers yet. Tipper Gore was as wrong can be. And Snoop Dogg at the Olympics proved it. So don't get on your high horse about whatever's going on today, because 30 years from now, you don't know who's going to represent America and who you and your kids might find to be a cultural icon. Because a lot of them started out being derided. Look how it worked out for Snoop. More Hurtel right after this. Welcome back to Hurtel. Let's go overseas to the Ukraine-Russia conflict. We hadn't talked about that in a while. Some interesting developments have happened. What's happening basically is, and I'm going to broad brush this really widely. You need to look into this yourself. A lot of the information is really hard to keep up with because Russian propaganda, Ukraine obviously needs a big PR win. So you got to, even if you support Ukraine, which I do, I think they have every right to defend themselves. I think Russia is clearly the aggressor here. Ukraine also pumps out plenty of propaganda for reasons that you could understand, but it's hard to get the accurate information. Here's what we do know for sure. There was a large-scale movement of troops by Ukraine into the Kursk region that is Russian territory. It's interesting historically because Kursk is some of the most blood-soaked ground in all the world. It's the site of one of, if not one of the biggest battles in all of human history, Russia versus Germany, the Soviet Russians. It's definitely the largest tank battle ever was around places that we're talking about in this area, Kiev, Kursk, a lot of blood spilled in World War II here. So it's kind of ironic twist that the Russians, who really praise, you know, what they call the Great Patriotic War, one of their greatest victories against the Germans, is kind of where Ukraine hit them here. So there's some symbolism here as well. This is not an invasion. Ukraine's not trying to invade Russia for the purposes of conquest. Like Russia tried to shut, they thought they were going to take Kiev in 3 days and all of Ukraine in a month. That didn't happen clearly. What's happening here is they have very strategically and very smartly done a raid into Russian territory for a couple of reasons. One is, like I just mentioned, they need a big PR hit because international support has been somewhat wobbly lately. Winter is coming when there's not going to be a lot of fighting and movement, and you're going to need to be able to get some headlines now to sustain through the winter. Also, strategically, there's a couple things they're probably trying to do. Now, some of this is speculated, but it's educated. I've reached out to some folks. I've studied this. I've read this myself. I keep up to this, even though we haven't been talking on the show because we've been busy with things like the presidential election. This does a couple things. One is it's a blow to Putin's argument that this is just a special operation. Remember, he used that term, that this was going to be easy. This will freak out the Russian people. This is something that's not going to be able to be contained, having to evacuate. I think they're trying to evacuate something like 100,000 Russians right now to get them out of the way of this. That sort of thing is going to break through the propaganda hold that the Putin regime has on Russia. This is making Russia feel it. This is making Russia understand that they are at war themselves and it can come back on them. The other thing it does strategically is, if you look at the map, now all that pressure that's been on those stagnant lines, Ukraine, the Donbass, all that region, Russia's not going to have any choice. They're going to have to pull troops out of there and bring them up to Kursk to try to deal with this and to squeeze this pocket. Now, the Ukrainians know they're not going to hold this territory. They are trying to bait the Russians into moving massive forces up to them, and then they'll pull back, either a fighting retreat or they'll just pull back and let it go and let the Russians have it. The other thing that accomplishes, besides just pulling a lot of troops there, maybe giving them somewhere else to explore, because even the Russian army that has been somewhat depleted over the years, they're going to have to, you know, they can't be everywhere at once. So that's one strategy. The other strategy here is a little more geopolitical than just military, but Russia's line, and it's a lie, but their line has been, well, of course we want peace. Let's just freeze the lines of gain where they are, because their whole point here is, if they couldn't have all of the Ukraine, they wanted the land bridge in the Crimea, which is also occupied territory, by the way. If we had stood up to Russia when they went into Ukraine, if we would have stood up to Russia when they went into Chechnya, if we would have stood up to Russia when they went into Georgia, we wouldn't have had the Ukraine conflict, but that's another rant for another day. They want that land bridge in the Crimea, but a couple things have changed. One is they basically had to pull all their naval forces out of the Black Sea because the Ukrainians keep sinking them with their drone technology and other things. And two is the Crimea now, with some of the things the Ukrainians are doing, is very, very vulnerable. And having just a land bridge with the way they're using their drone technology and stuff, you're going to have a hard time holding that. So, of course, they want to freeze the lines because that would calcify being able to keep their land bridge in the Crimea, which is one of their real strategic objectives here. What this does now is they can't argue line of gains anymore, because now Ukraine is sitting on top of what Russia considers their sovereign territory, Kursk. Now, again, they're not going to hold this for very long, probably only a couple of days or a week or two at a time. As soon as the Russians move forces to it, these forces will move back. And then I think you'll see a counterstrike wherever they find a weakness that the Russians are pulling back on the main lines, either in the Donbass or in greater Ukraine. That's some of the stuff I think is going on here. It's a big PR win. It's a big morale boost. It causes some dissension at home for Putin. It's a brilliant strategy so far. Now, like everything else, how do you follow up? How do you sustain it? What do you do next? I think they're setting up one last tactical assault or offensive or whatever you want to call it. I think they're waiting to see where Russia pulls these troops from, and then they'll try to strike wherever Russia pulls these troops from to squeeze this pocket back down and to retake Kursk. I think that's probably coming next. We will see. Maybe they're just happy with the PR win. They pull back, try not to lose any troops they don't have to, and call it a win. We will see. Remember the responses here, though, too. Ukraine has stuck mostly with military targets. Putin's response to everything Ukraine does is to bomb supermarkets and apartment buildings and schools and hospitals, children's cancer wards, these things. These things are not the same. Don't get caught up in the hype. Whether it's Ukraine and Russia or Israel and Palestine or the god-awful stuff we're seeing in Africa right now, Myanmar, pick any conflict in the world. The number one way that you get really bad war is to have a false peace. And people don't want to hear that because they just want, well, we got to have peace at all costs. No, peace at all costs is not peace. Peace at all costs is setting up the next war that's going to be even worse because you set up peace by false means. All that Russia's offered when they said peace is false. They invaded Ukraine for no good reason other than conquest and expansion. They wanted to eradicate, by Putin's own words, they wanted to eradicate Ukrainian culture and language and history. That should all be Russian, according to Putin and his stooges. When you see somebody like that, no, they're not interested in peace. They're just trying to figure out how they can get what they want by other means. So the people that are screaming the most about peace, always be a little skeptical about them, because I want peace. I want peace in a way that only people that have seen war can really want it deep in their soul, because war is a horrible, horrible thing. But false peace will always bring worse war down the road. And you're better off fighting the battle in front of you and getting the best peace you can for that, and the most just peace you can. It'll never be perfect, but it has to be, you know, somewhat amicable all the way around, or it ain't going to last very long. Remember that in Ukraine and Russia. Remember that in Palestine, Israel. Remember that whatever conflict you want to apply it to. The reason Europe has had peace for 70 years, for the most part, with a few exceptions, was not just because we won World War II and crushed the Nazis, because of the Marshall Plan. It's because how the Allies, especially the United States of America, rebuilt Western Europe at a lot of time and money and effort. That's what brought peace, real peace, a long-lasting peace, one of the longest, most prosperous periods of peace in the history of Europe, post-World War II, because we didn't just win the war, we won the peace, and we had an amicable peace. And people go, well, yeah, you leveled firebomb cities and leveled. Yeah, I know all that too, but after World War I, you know, the thing was to break Germany down, and we did, and it gave rise to the Nazis eventually. So winning the peace is very important. Not accepting the cessation of hostilities over a bad peace is also important. And one of the main things Ukraine has done here is they have maybe given them chance that whatever settlement ends up coming out of this, although I think it'll be a temporary settlement because Russia's never going to stop wanting the Ukraine. Whatever peace Ukraine gets out of this just got a little bit of a stronger negotiating spot, because they just showed that they can strike back. And the only reason they really haven't before is because we've been restraining them. If we take the handcuffs off, they can probably put some real pressure on Russia. And yes, Russia needs to lose this war, because wars of aggression are not good, and they need to lose it. And as long as we can do it like this, by supporting them without any of our own troops on the ground, that's a pretty good policy to pursue. Just screaming peace at me or yelling that I'm a warmonger don't affect me one little bit. Because I understand, and I hope you understand, peace is the exception in all of human history. It is a precious thing. It's worth fighting for. It's worth dying for. But if you don't win the peace, it's all for naught. So when we pick our battles and we fight our battles, make sure we continue on to a victory that ensures a just and fair and lasting peace, or at least as long as it can possibly last, until human behavior demands more war. More Hertel, right after this. Welcome back to Hertel. It is hurricane season. We are currently, if you're in the southeast United States, you are going to get rain for about four straight days as the stalled remains of Hurricane Debbie just parks itself and dumps a whole bunch of rain, lots of flooding, lots of damage, few deaths already. We hope everybody's fine. If you're in that listening area, please keep your head down, listen to local authorities, make smart decisions. But it brings up one of my real bugaboos in news media. The absolute stupidity of sending weather people out into a hurricane just so you can get the live shot of them showing that it's windy and rainy. We, the American people, know it's windy and rainy. Quit sending people out there. The AI stuff, where a couple of years ago, I decided to channel that loathing of this idiotic ritual of our media to send these sacrificial people out into the bad weather just for the ratings and giggles thereof. And I wrote a piece about it. It's called Information But Dumber, Louder, and Wetter. It's been published in a couple different places from 2020. I will read it to you here because I think it is apropos of the coverage we continue to see for idiotic reasons. And then you get into the really stupid stuff too, by the way, of people like, you know, they'll get in a rowboat and people walk by because the water's only knee deep, or they find the deepest possible ditch so the water looks chest level instead of the, you know, couple inches that it really is. I can't stand this. It drives me crazy. But anyway, let me read from this piece. Information, but dumber, louder, and wetter by me. Imagine, if you will, we had modern media in the age of ancient Greek mythology. Daedalus, industrial Athenian MacGyver that he was, has fashioned two pairs of wings to escape from the Isle of Crete. He tests out one pair and gives the other to his son Icarus with a warning to hold the middle path between the sun and the sea, not getting too close to either. Icarus, of course, gets all up in his giddy feels about being able to fly, flashes his dad deuces, and posts YOLO on Instagram before melting the wax from flying too close to the sun. Thus wingless, Icarus falls from the sky and into the sea, perishing in the process, and with the indignity of not having recorded it so that it would go viral. Daedalus mourns his beloved but fatally stupid son, but is annoyed when the media shows up. Having missed the money shot, the intrepid rapid response team from CNN, the Cretan News Network, decides to add a little background and sizzle to the stand-up by having one reporter report on a dramatic shot of the coastline of Crete, while another flies just high enough to partially melt the wings, and yet another flies just low enough to get wet and inhibit the lift of theirs. By the time they throw it back to Heracles in the studios, you have burned a reporter, a hypothermic and wet reporter, a happy producer, and a grieving Daedalus, whose Belichickian grump and cursing was not a usable cut. But he didn't name the nearby Icarian Sea near Icaria for Icarus, so there is that. No word on whether that had a cryon read at the bottom of the screen, but rumor has it the fact-checkers found it all to be mostly true. It sounds ridiculous until you realize this is exactly what we are doing every single hurricane that makes landfall. Not to pick on certain people here, but since apparently it is some sort of time-honored ritual to make your meteorologists sacrifice themselves to the optics god in order to consider them legitimate, and they all do it, but is enough enough? It's windy, we get it. It's raining, we get it. It's flooding, we get it. You don't have the good sense God gave a pigeon if it means a wicked awesome live shot. We get it. None of that is enhanced much by making some poor weather person subject themselves to it for a live shot. In fact, technology has far outstripped this silliness. Graphics can put a storm surge from a hurricane into a neighborhood or living room, and a CGI overlay is far more informative. The amazing technology of cameras these days means there is only one reason for anyone to ever be out in the shot anyway, for the attention of it. Which is why you get some folks who gussy up their live shots by making the water look deeper than it is, or yelling loudly even when it's not needed, or other effects that can be ruined by folks walking past you while you are on a live screen in their t-shirts and Crocs. We get it. Hurricanes are big doings in the weather world and are often the highest profile stage on which to shine. Hurricanes are guaranteed sustained ratings for networks and views for content providers. So, of course, the human instinct is going to be to get all giddied up in your flying and push the visuals envelope even higher. Closer to the goal of fame and fortune. Closer to that next prize position up the meteorological ladder. Closer to not having to do remote shots from the Webster Springs Volunteer Fire Department's annual pancake breakfast and a permanent seat in that high-tech HVAC-equipped studio. But you know intrepid meteorologists can be Icarus from in front of the green screen. Stop insulting the audience's intelligence, stroking your own ego, and aggrandizing reckless behavior in the weather world's version of if it bleeds, it leads. You could be the trendsetter. The one that turns the tide to a new era of reason and logic in covering weather and phenomenon free from the mythologies of the past. Be the light bringer, live shot weather folks. Don't just keep the tradition of being wet Icarus. They aren't going to name anything after you that way anyway. I'll link to the piece. It's just one of those things that drive me crazy. It's stupid. Why are we doing this? Stop doing it. Live shots in the hurricane. people against, we need to get some kind of nonprofit going. Have signs made, merch made up, have a rally, have a protest. More Hurtel right after this. Welcome back to Herd Tell. I want to end today's show with the column I wrote for the Fayette Tribune. That's my local paper in West Virginia. I'm happy to contribute and write for them and appreciate the opportunity to support local newspapers, local news media outlets. So understand when I wrote this, I know a national audience will read it, but I'm really talking to my friends, my family. This is the paper that lands on my mom and dad's kitchen table. Okay, so to understand the context, I'm talking about a big idea here, but I'm writing it for people that I know and care about the most. From the Fayette Tribune, this is me writing. While doing some research and reading, I stumbled across a quote from eminent historian David McCullough. By the way, that's the guy that narrated the Civil War series, so you know his voice probably if you don't never read his books, but you should read his books as well. That gave me pause. The quote is this: "Sadly, too many today take for granted public schools, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, equality before the law, forgetting that these were ever novel and daring ideas once. The politics of the moment is a constant exercise in placing and deflecting blame. This eternal thrust and parry of every news item, current event, election, and issue is the wave machine that keeps the news cycle turning. Blame's a powerful thing. Blame is powerful enough to swing elections, change the directions of careers and countries, to affect history and legacy. The powerful and the wannabe powerful spend a great deal of time and effort on blame and not being the object thereof. It's funny how you never hear a politician or content creator blaming good old-fashioned complacency for too much. Not enough of a big bad for the algorithms to really get trending, probably, but the evidence all around us in America is that we have taken much for granted. Complacency is the opposite of novel and daring ideas. George III was good and complacent with some of the disgruntled and put upon overseas subject until they decided to dissolve the political bands which had connected the American colonies to the British crown. Taking up arms against the most powerful empire in the world was anything but complacent. Most of the same leaders sat down after the fighting to figure out what a new American government would look like. The bitter fights over creating what we now know as our Constitution from drafting the ratification took almost 3 years and put the fledgling country closer to coming apart than the British Army ever did. And part of that contentious ratification fight, the Bill of Rights, was crafted to address concerns and was itself formally added to the United States Constitution as the first 10 amendments in 1791. The First Amendment includes no blame for the raucous context of its creation, but it does contain five essential freedoms. Quoting, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, end quote. For the 1780s, these were novel and daring ideas taken from ancient Greek philosophy remixed with English jurisprudence, and a radical idea that became the greatest example in all of human history of a free people self-governing. Quick look at the headlines and social media of today shows we are taking it all for granted. There are open calls for governmental power to not just protect, but to enforce and impose religious belief. The technological revolution of the internet, smartphones, and social media has folks debating what is protected speech and what isn't in ways not even imaginable even only a few years ago. The free press that is essential to a free people struggles under the weight of a business model, corporate and political interests, and a lack of faith in the fourth estate by the people. Protests that are peaceful go mostly ignored, while riots, violence, destruction, and mayhem give the peaceful protests a bad name, drowning out any chance of a needed message getting across. A redress of grievances seems unattainable to folks who see the political class that is mostly above a legal system that feeds on the lowly to create more crime than it solves and dispenses more injustice than the justice a citizenry rightly should expect. But the blame for the sorry state of affairs is not in Washington, D.C. alone, or in state capitals, or in legislatures. The cycle is perpetuated by candidates of all stripes and belief blaming the current, meaning the office holder, to become the next, without all that much changing. The blame in a representative democracy cannot be at the reflection, the representatives, but must be rightly placed on where it is to be presented. We, the people. The novel and daring approach would be to set aside complacency. Take an honest look in the mirror that is our democratic republic and the elected officials we have stocked it with, and mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor to do something about it besides say bad things about our own electoral judgments on social media. But there is no honor in taking our freedoms in the country we have been handed by the generations before for granted. Complacency has put the fortunes of our country at great peril, and the whole hot mess of the present can be traced back to taking for granted that our lives need to be pledged to each other in the common cause of a better country, in the actions of protecting the core freedoms afforded us on paper by living them out loud daily. If we do not, we might be the generation of which future historians soon say they had freedom of religion, freedom of speech, equality before the law in America. Once, that thought should be something we as Americans should not be able to live with. Me writing in the Fayette Tribune. That'll do it for Herd Tell. Got questions, comments, feedback? Think we're not covering something? Wonder why we're covering something? Don't think we're doing it right? Love to hear from you. HerdTellShow@gmail.com. HerdTellShow on the Twitter. Would love to hear from you. I'm at 4 for the Fire on the Twitter X machine, whatever you're calling it this week. iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, YouTube, anywhere you can get any kind of programming, audio or otherwise. We're even on Audible. If you do Audible books off Amazon, you can get our podcast right there on Audible. Just search it, Herd Tell Show, Andrew Donaldson, neither one. It'll come right up. But if you want one-stop shopping for everything we do, whether it's writing, media appearances, recaps every Sunday, we do a newsletter called News Notes and Notions that recaps all the Herd Tell episodes, has some original writing from me also in that, herdtell.substack.com. You will get everything. You can sign up. There is a free subscription option, and everything we do will go right into your inbox, and you'll never miss a thing. We don't charge you for that, but if you want to give us money, we will take it. You can click a link if you want to support us there. So wherever you and yours are, across the street or around the world, we hope you're well. We hope you are well fed, and we'll talk to you again real soon for more Herd Tell.
All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a Creative Content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.